Americans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
It's a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show coming your way from San Francisco and supported by great listeners, including Nancy Mrazek, Teresa Paris, Susan Fellows, and Joe Kells. If you're inclined and able, you can take out a voluntary subscription starting at $5 a month. All the information and the links are on my homepage on the right-hand side at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, we're going to meet Jeff Warrick, writer, producer, director, and lead editor of a movie about subliminal suggestion. It's not subliminable, it's subliminal. It's called Programming the Nation. That's coming up in our second segment. But first, can you believe the story about the Iranian-American used car dealer who hooked up with the Mexican drug cartel and at the behest of the Quds Force decided to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to Washington? It's unbelievable. And Secretary of State Clinton said, you gotta believe it. That's what started me wondering. Yes, as soon as I heard about this alleged plot, my bullshit detector went into overdrive. And it hasn't really settled down since. There's been some great alternative reporting on this that hasn't really made it into the corporate media. Gareth Porter, just 2 days after the revelation of this alleged plot, went public with a theory that this could have been primarily a drug deal and that the assassination plot was just an accessory. Joe Lauria joins us now. He writes for many publications from the United Nations, including the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London. And in an article exclusive to the Boiling Frogs Post, he raised additional questions about this alleged plot that has led to a serious escalation of tensions between the United States and Iran. Joe Lauria, good to talk to you today.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me on your show.
And, you know, here in podcast land, we don't have language restrictions, so did your bullshit detector go off when you heard this story?
Oh, it did indeed. I immediately heard this. I thought, this is just impossible to believe, and I tweeted it immediately that unless Iran was suicidal, it doesn't make any sense that they would be involved in that. And I was heartened when I got to the UN later that day and spoke to some of my colleagues in the mainstream media, and they likewise were completely stunned by this and didn't believe it. One of the reporters for a very large paper said they called it cockamamie, and they just didn't. And no one believed it there, which I found interesting. That even as a mainstream reporters found this very, very hard to believe. And then, of course, we heard people like Bob Baer, the former CIA agent, and the Middle East, and Gary Sick at Columbia University, people who know a lot more about Iran than I do, and most people in this country, who immediately went on the record saying it was an unbelievable story, that there's no way that the Al-Quds force, a highly professional elite force, would ever make the kinds of mistakes that they did in terms of who they asked to carry this alleged assassination out and wiring more than $10,000. It seemed designed to be uncovered. So it's just an extraordinarily incredible story. And again, as I said, many, many mainstream people have come forward to say that this not believe all the American officials, who then briefed government at the Security Council in the UN, admitted that it was hard to believe. And they didn't believe it at first, but they say they have evidence to prove that it's all true. And, you know, the main point of my article in Boiling Frogs is that if there is evidence, and this is true, it should come out in a courtroom.
Yeah.
We have a country supposedly run by laws, and there is here an indictment, not an indictment, rather, just a federal FBI criminal complaint at this point. No grand jury has yet been impaneled on this. I just checked a few minutes ago. Don't see any stories mentioning a grand jury being impaneled or being selected. I find odd. But if, in fact, this is a real story, and we can't exclude the fact that it might be,
yeah,
this is to be proved in a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And then action could be taken if, in fact, it's linked to high officials in the Iranian government, not rogue members of al-Quds force. So this is a story debated in this country for a couple of decades now. As I point out in the piece, the Clinton administration tried the al-Qaeda members of the African embassy bombing in the federal courthouse of the Southern District of New York in Lower Manhattan, where I was in the courtroom covering it for the Boston Globe. And there I saw al-Qaeda members sitting on the witness stand testifying. And they were convicted by a civilian jury and sent to life in prison. It was proven in a courtroom. Now, the Bush administration came in, and they completely ridiculed this idea, and they think it's purely a national security matter. You don't need proof, except what the intelligence agencies say and what the administration believes and tells the public, and they can take military action. Now, here, the Obama administration tried to do what the Clintons did, but we had the supposed mastermind, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who was involved in the 9/11, may have killed Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter. They wanted to put him on trial in the very same court in New York in Lower Manhattan. As you know, the right wing howled about that. Obama backed down, and they made it a military trial. And here we have a sort of a hybrid of a criminal proceeding, a FBI criminal complaint, and now we have also the U.S. going to the Security Council, where there were State Department officials, Justice Department, CIA, and FBI went inside the council and briefed one by one all 15 members of the Security Council to present evidence. And Russia and China is going to be needed to agree in order to have new sanctions on Iran or for any other kind of action that the U.S. may want the council to approve. They are very skeptical. But the U.S. allies have sort of believed what they were told. The question is whether they were given any kind of extra classified information, and we don't know that. And I suggested in my piece that we should be careful that this information may not be forged. And this is pure speculation on my part, but it's based on the fact that we know that the Niger uranium document was used to try to build a case for war against Iraq. And we know that that was a forgery. The U.S. was trying to say the famous 17 words of Bush in his State of the Union address, in which he said that they had evidence that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium for a nuclear weapon in Niger. It was a pure fabrication, that document.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the story is here, and that's the point. We don't know. There's so many questions, and that can only come out in the courtroom. Present the evidence, both sides will argue it, court will decide.
And
there's time for that. There's no time for that. They want to push this through, as the right wing in Congress and other conservatives are pushing now for some kind of action.
Well, and that's why I am so skeptical about this, because there is this rush to stop scrutiny of the underlying allegations here and just escalate tensions with Iran. So let's go back to the underlying case. We have this guy, Mansour Arbabsiar, who lives in Texas, an Iranian-American used car dealer. He is the worst spy you could ever imagine or candidate for a spy. He's a drinker. He loses his cell phone. He's a guy who simply doesn't rise to the level of some sort of an agent entrusted by the Iranians. And as you point out, and this is something that I have raised previously, Joe, virtually every sting operation in this country, every prosecution of a so-called domestic terrorism case, has involved a paid government informant. And right away, we've got one here. It's the DEA informant who Arbabsiar met with starting in May of this year. And, you know, one of the theories here advanced by Gareth Porter, the very talented journalist, simply based on reading the FBI's criminal complaint, is that they were working on moving heroin that originated in Afghanistan that was intercepted by the Iranians as it was they were attempting to smuggle it into Iran. So they're sitting on a cache of contraband, and they want to turn it into money. And so this would not be rising to the level of the supreme leader of Iran. These would be mid-level insiders who are trying to get cash for drugs. And where would be a great place to dump Afghan heroin that is currently in Iran? Well, nobody would expect it to show up in Mexico. And since we have a global world for all kinds of capital, we have to assume that drugs move in a global manner, too. So the strong implication here that deserves greater investigation is that this was primarily a relationship built around drugs, and that the implication, the suggestion of killing the Saudi ambassador at a restaurant in Washington appears to have originated with the DEA informant.
That could very well be. What we know is we're absolutely right. They interdict a lot of drugs coming out of Afghanistan and Iran, and police forces around the world are known to, you know, publicly destroy some of the drugs and then maybe keep some of it to sell. So the idea that the Al-Quds force somebody in there on their own without the knowledge of the rest of the government was doing that is certainly can't be dismissed. And the fact is that the relationship between our Bob Sierre and the DEA agent is very interesting, because we're supposed to believe by reading this federal complaint that Bob Sierre approached this drug dealer because he knew his aunt, and it just so happens he happened to be an undercover federal agent. Now the odds are very rare, very high that he would be able to he would choose the guy who was working for the U.S. It looks like it was the other way around, that the informant approached Bob Sierre. We learn at the beginning that this was supposed to be a kidnapping attempt, and later it became an assassination. But the idea that it was a drug deal is very possible, because the guy is a DEA agent, for example.
Yeah.
Drug enforcement agent. He's moving drugs. He's trying to uncover drugs. Two, Sierra had been arrested for a narcotics possession a year or two ago, other petty crimes that he'd committed. So he was involved in drugs, and people who lived around his house have told reporters that they saw coming in and out, and they assumed there were drug deals going on. So the very likely had a relationship with narcotics to begin with, and he's dealing with a DEA agent, and there was all this heroin that's in Iran that could be moved there. Where did it become a kidnapping plot and then an assassination? It's not clear, although the complaint alleges that this came from Iran, that the order came from a cousin of Bob Sierre, who is a senior commander of the Al-Quds force, and that money was then shipped from Iran through a second country to the U.S. and was uncovered by in a dummy Justice Department account. This is the most unbelievable part, that they would ship $49,000 twice, knowing that would all the alarm bells would start ringing, that this kind of a shipment of more than $10,000 would automatically mean an investigation of where this money came from.
Joe, I can't even go into my own bank where the teller knows me and make a deposit of $3,000 from one of my own accounts to another without it being approved by the manager on duty. And so for anybody who fancies themselves as an expert in espionage to be wiring two chunks of $50,000, and the amount that arrived was just less the wire service charges, so $49 and change, that is such a red flag. And nobody who has any expertise in moving drugs and laundering money would attempt to do it that way. That doesn't pass anybody's smell test.
No, it looked like it was intended to be discovered. And also, Mr. Bob Sierre initially, they say, confessed everything and didn't want an attorney. He waived his right to an attorney, which is odd. And he confessed this whole thing. But in court, when he appeared a couple of days ago, his lawyer, who he now has a lawyer, said that he would plead not guilty. Now, what is that about? If he confessed, why is he not pleading not guilty? Is it because he confessed to a drug deal and now he's going to plead not guilty to an assassination attempt? We don't know this. But somehow he's changed. It has changed from his confession that he was involved in this assassination. As I say, it just doesn't make sense, but it has to play itself out in a courtroom. And I don't think the U.S. government is going to sit around, the Obama administration, waiting for this thing to go through the legal process, which takes time. They're building a case now to punish Iran somehow for this event, which has all these incredible questions and holes in it.
Joe Lauria, in your article at BoilingFrogsPost.com, you share a personal anecdote from May of 2009 when you went home one night and discovered an FBI raid at a synagogue near your home. Tell us about this.
Yep, I'm sitting right now looking at it. It's right below my window. There's actually two synagogues. There was a lot of police there, and it went up, and there's Ray Kelly, the police chief of New York. He's holding a news conference, which I then joined, and they explained that they had broken up this terrorist attack, planned attack on these two synagogues here in the Bronx. And it was great work by the FBI, and they saved the day, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how it was pretty much reported. But I asked a question of Kelly about whether this was a sting operation, because the way he was describing it, it just sounded that way. They ignored the question, but afterward I spoke to a very high official of the FBI in New York who told me that they had sent an informant to this town of Newburgh, New York, a very depressed town, in a black neighborhood of some black Muslim mosque, and they found a couple of guys who they then talked into, or that's what the defense was trying to say. They got them to start this plot where they were also going to shoot down some planes at an Air Force base upstate New York. And they were bringing phony bombs to the synagogues here in the Bronx. And they picked the target. They chose the guys. They also paid them at least $50,000 each. And they were giving them marijuana up until the day that it happened. And as soon as they arrived here below my window, they were arrested. They were supposed to put what turned out to be, of course, a fake bomb. The judge in the case did not agree with the jury's decision of guilty. She said clearly that this was a case of the FBI talking these guys into a detention. She said, quote, there was no nefarious plot to disrupt, because the FBI did not disrupt a nefarious plot, because there was no nefarious plot. It was completely contrived by the FBI. And this is the judge saying this in the courtroom after the verdict came down.
Let me just quote from your article where you quote her commentary from the bench. The FBI created acts of terrorism out of the suspect's fantasies of bravado and bigotry, and then made those fantasies come true. The government did not have to infiltrate and foil some nefarious plot. There was no nefarious plot to foil. So this is one, as you point out, of at least 17 cases of alleged domestic terrorist suspects who had been infiltrated by FBI informants. And it was the FBI informants in J. Edgar Hoover COINTELPRO style who introduced the provocations, who came up with the idea, for example, in South Miami to blow up the Sears Tower after taking an oath of allegiance to Osama bin Laden. All of that concocted by the FBI informant. This stuff is incredible.
Yeah. And in the context of the Iranian plot, we have to look at whether something like this happened again. It is a sting operation. The issue is whether this plot was really already going on, and or was it suggested by the agents to Abbas Sierre, who then got his cousin to agree to do this, if in fact this cousin really did agree to do this. And we have to look at who benefits from this, and there's a new story out today you may have seen in the New York Times, which is very interesting. Iran is saying that this guy, his co-conspirator, Gholam Shakouri, who apparently met with Abbas Sierre in Iran, according to the complaint, gave him money there and then arranged for the money to be wired to the United States, mm-hmm. who was going to take part in the bombing, is actually a member of the People's Mujahideen of Iran, which is this very strange group that has a base inside Iraq that is on the terrorism list, although it has some high-profile U.S. People like former Attorney General Mukasey and Senator Torricelli of New Jersey lobbying for them now to get off the terrorism list. They are, if your listeners don't know about it, they started in the 70s against the Shah as a very left-wing group. But they've evolved over the years into a very bizarre cult led by two people who are a man and a woman, his wife, Masoud Rajavi and Mariam Rajavi. They have these people totally devoted to them. They stay in a base. There's only about 6,000 or 7,000 of them inside Iraq. They were protected by Saddam Hussein. during all those years, and now the new government of Iraq moved against them and raided them, but they still exist. And the Iranians are saying that Mr. Gholam Shokouri is actually a member of this group. And as the New York Times points out, if that's true, and the Iranians say they learned that from Interpol, that would be a huge embarrassment to the United States. That would be clear that this was cooked up by this crazy anti-Iranian group, this cult. But that's another thing we have to look at. Could the U.S. officials themselves have been fooled by this? I wouldn't be surprised. They saw all this wire transfers. They heard things. Maybe they themselves were fooled by an elaborate plot that could have been put together by intelligence agencies of other countries or this group.
And, Joe Lauria, we have a clear statement from the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei of Iran. He is denying any involvement by the Iranian government or at his direction. And this is one of those cases where I have to assume he might be telling the truth. And because the American media is so tilted against just assuming that he could possibly tell the truth, I go back to Saddam Hussein. In January of 2003, Dan Rather went to Baghdad, got the exclusive interview with him, and Saddam Hussein turned out to be telling the truth when he denied that he had any WMD. And I later asked Dan Rather about that. I said, that was a powerful interview. And did you ever stop to think that he might actually be telling you the truth? And Rather, despite all the way, this was after he'd been fired by CBS and been through the ringer, he still seemed kind of oblivious to the implications of his own interview. And he just said, well, I didn't think much about it at the time.
Right, Iraq was demonized, Iran is demonized, everything they say is a lie. And what's the point then of having a trial in a courtroom? Because we know that Iran is guilty. And frankly, in the public opinion, probably would feel right now in the U.S. that they are guilty of this plot. And that's maybe the purpose of the whole thing, just to stir up public support for some action against Iran. And the court case be damned. It doesn't matter. And it'll take place over months, maybe years. But in the meantime, they can take action. Saddam was telling the truth. He presented this huge dossier to the UN in which he showed that he had destroyed all the weapons. It turned out nobody believed it. It turned out to be true. So why would Iran, what do they have to gain from doing this? Really nothing. And just not to do it in this way. Aside from how they did it, which was so botched and amateurish, and this group of Quds is very, very professional, what would they gain by this right now? They don't need a conflict with the United States. They would lose that, but they can cause a lot of damage. And they don't need to present a ready-made pretext for conflict or even more sanctions against them by trying to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington. There are other targets closer to the Gulf if they wanted to kill them, but they've been out of the terrorism business for a while now anyway, at least in the Gulf area. And it's just an unbelievable plot that would not help Iran at all. So, yes, I think it's believable that when the leader Ayatollah says he had nothing to do with it, we should probably believe him in this case. And I think all the big experts, Iranian experts in the U.S., do believe him.
Joe, let's go into speculation mode here for a moment, because as I look at this, it's very hard to resist the temptation to analyze this through the prism of the president's reelection efforts. And we know that David Axelrod has said, gee, there are a lot of ways to get to 270 electoral votes. And with the president's Democratic progressive base softening in its support of him, and with the virulence of the attacks from the right that have had a very severe impact on the president, he is looking for a kind of third way to win reelection next year. And let me offer a domestic example. Here in California, we are bristling because in the last week or so, the U.S. attorneys of the Justice Department have announced a major crackdown on medical marijuana. Now, there's existing tension between state and federal law. That's obvious to everyone. But for the first two-plus years of his term, the president basically ignored the issue, and medical marijuana dispensaries in California were permitted to operate. Now they're using the full power of the federal government to crack down, cracking down on landlords in order to cut off clinics, and also even cracking down on newspapers and radio stations that accepted advertising from these legal entities here in California. And I believe that it's all for political play, political benefit. The calculation is they know they're going to win California no matter what. And so let's beat up California to win some votes in, say, Alabama or Mississippi or North Dakota. And with that as a model, I look at this Iranian sting operation, and I feel that the president is trying to mend fences over what happened when Netanyahu came here in May of this year and basically upstaged him and confronted him in a way that I found pretty rude and disrespectful. But it appears that the president is trying to win Jewish American votes by taking this strong, firm stand against Iran just a year before his reelection. Do you see any juice in that analysis?
Well, if you look at the speech that he made at the UN last month, this was one of the most pro-Israeli speeches Obama had ever made. He never mentioned the 67 borders. He didn't mention anything about Palestinian suffering. And people have interpreted that as an opening salvo in his reelection campaign. But, I mean, this is a very hard thing to prove, obviously. But there does seem to be a shift in Obama's thinking in regard to Israel. And this particular plot here is one where it fits into efforts by the Israelis to get American support to take action, military action against Iran. We know of this FBI informant who was recently arrested and put 20 months in jail for leaking information. He was an FBI translator who had been translating wiretaps out of the Israeli embassy in Washington, and he learned that there was a concerted effort to try to get U.S. support for an attack on Iran by the dealings with the press and with congressmen, and he leaked some of that to a blogger, and he was arrested. So there's no question that Israel needs U.S. support for this, for a possible attack against Iran. And they also got the bunker busting bomb. This is a crucial part, I think, of the story. The Bush administration wouldn't give it to Iran anymore. Despite Dick Cheney wanting to go ahead, Bush had learned a couple of things. One, that Iraq didn't go as well as he thought. And the plan, according to Ariel Sharon, was quoted saying a few weeks after the invasion of Iraq, that Syria and Iran were next. And that Cheney wanted to keep pushing that all the way through, but Bush saw that it went poorly in Iraq. And that also, the National Intelligence Estimate came out and said that Iran, at that time, had at least, for that period, had stopped trying to build a nuclear weapon. He says in his memoir, that's the reason he didn't go ahead with it, didn't get the bunker-busting bombs to Israel. But now we see Obama making that speech, and we see him giving the bunker-busting bombs. We know that Israel's trying to get public support in the U.S. for an operation against Iran. And now we have this Iranian plot. I mean... again, this could be all true. It's just, as I said, so experts who know more than I do about Iran don't believe it. And if it is an unbelievable made-up story, if it's a thing that originated as a drug operation and it turned into a kidnapping and then the assassination and the complaint, federal complaint does not tell us anything about how it moved from the kidnapping to the assassination. And we also know that the agent suggested where the bombing would take place in a restaurant, that fictitious restaurant, the U.S. officials have admitted that they mean the name of the restaurant. And they also call it a weapon of mass destruction in this federal complaint, which I think is very misleading and politically charged because, and everyone knows, is biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. The complaint never suggests any of those things would be used, just a bomb. Mm-hmm. It would kill a lot of people, so that's a weapon of mass destruction. If you take all these things in context, it looks like that this plot could be part of an effort to build support for action against Iran. And my argument is this has to be called into a courtroom. You started a legal process here. Maybe these guys are guilty. Let's prove them in our system of laws is in the courtroom, not in public opinion and not at the UN Security Council and not in bellicose statements coming out of right-wingers in Congress. It's very dangerous. It's either going to be a criminal case, and we follow that through to the end, or we're going to see this case being used without knowing the facts, without answering these very troubling questions as a way to ratchet up tension with Iran, which, I'm not a supporter of the Ayatollah or Iranian government. I think they have a layer of democracy. Above that, they have this theocracy. I think they're a repressive system. They treat the opposition very well. And we've got Rashid riding around on motorcycles beating people with sticks. That's not the point here.
The point is we have to
avoid a war with Iran at all costs, I believe, because it will be totally devastating to the world economy if they cut off oil supplies out of the Gulf. And the damage that it would do, and Israel would be attacked, It would be, as Ray McGovern, the former Security Analyst, says, this would make Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq look like a picnic. I think it would be absolutely interesting now.
Yeah.
How to deal with Iran and the nuclear program is a sticky issue, but I don't see conflict being the way to do it. And if this plot is being used to build a case for war against Iran, it's a big mistake, in my opinion, that has to go through the courts to prove it first, and then to see what we do.
And, Joe, there's a troubling pattern that is developing here that essentially is Barack Obama saying to the American people, trust me. So it started with the killing of Osama bin Laden, where the shifting stories of how it happened and what they found when they got to Abbottabad undermined confidence in the story. Then we have the targeted assassination of American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki and the dubious process that was used. We still don't know who the members of the Security Council subcommittee are who manage the kill or capture list. There's no really legal process that is apparent to us at this point. And now we learn that last weekend, drone strikes in Yemen killed not one but two of Awlaki's children under the age of 18. Now, when does this, require some sort of oversight or accountability? And when will the media in this country demand proof when the president just summarily kills people and we're told that it's okay?
Well, Jake Tapper, the White House correspondent on the ABC, did demand proof of a very widely seen video of him going after the White House spokesman, asking where is the proof? Where is the due process? They've just assassinated an American citizen, which makes it all the more odd that they would come out with this federal complaint and begin a legal proceeding against these alleged Iranian plotters. Why not just go with the story that we know the CIA told Iran's doing it? Believe me. In this case, I've actually put forward a federal complaint. Presumably there's going to be a grand jury, although nothing has been found yet. This is what you should have seen for Awlaki. You need proof. You should do it in our court system. The guys are guilty. Then we talk about what kind of action to take against them. But that was absent from the Awlaki story, but it's present here, and it's bizarre as it would be if they would put this complaint out and start a legal proceeding and then go forward to the Security Council and act like these guys are guilty already. So I don't understand the play there between this complaint and the political side of it. But in the other ones, absolutely, there was no legal procedure at all in terms of the killing of those American citizens. And the press, as I said, only the ABC White House correspondent spoke up about that.
Well, and I appreciate that Jake Tapper did that, but the very next day, Joe, there was a presidential news conference. Tapper was called on, and I suppose his editors or superiors told him what question to ask. But he didn't ask about Awlaki. I believe he asked about the jobs bill and or Solyndra.
I didn't know that, but I don't know what to say about that.
The president gave a 55-minute news conference and not a single question about the killing of al-Awlaki. And I'm just very troubled by that on all sides, that the president would fail to provide any proof and that the media would fail to demand it.
Well, I hope that the media now, because we've got, as I said, these experts speaking out first. So this doesn't even have to be raised by the press, the questions about this Iranian plot. We've got major experts here like Garrett Sick and Bob Barr and others saying this thing's very fishy. And if you read the complaint, there's a lot of fishy things in there, like who approached whom and why would Iran be doing this and why did they send $49,000 towards them when they know that that would raise alarm bells. These things have to be pursued, but you wonder whether the press has it in them to do that. That's their job right now, to demand proof of this stuff. And even if it's classified stuff, it's now that they've put it out publicly and the Security Council and made these statements, we need to see the evidence now. I mean, that could ruin their case. I mean, if they're going to do it, this should have been done in a courtroom to present the evidence, even classified evidence, to prove this case. But now that it's out there, I think we should see that now. And Gary Sick said that. Congress and the press need to ask some really hard questions about this Iranian plot before it goes forward. And let's hope that they do that. I think it's irresponsible not to now, as all these questions are out there.
Yeah, and I give credit to the new public editor at the New York Times, who has criticized his own paper on these issues and demanded that they work harder. Joe Lauria, before we wrap up, my next segment is an interview with filmmaker Jeff Warrick about subliminal suggestion and psychological operations. And I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts on the way political leaders have successfully used various techniques, including, you know, stories planted in the media and kind of deceptive proof offered via video and other media tools. Do you have any thoughts about that or any comments about the way the public is so easily persuaded these days? Even when we don't have the full story, what we get is a captivating video with a lot of powerful rhetoric behind it, and public attitudes are changed by these techniques.
Well, I'm recalling a book that I read way back when I was in college by a Canadian professor called Brian Wilson Key, Subliminal Seduction.
Well, that's
a book, if you remember that book.
Well, that's actually what triggered this film. The filmmaker read it in the 1970s. Yeah, so you're right on target.
I didn't know that. Okay. And he was showing how Madison Avenue advertising uses all these things. Well, you know, that can cross over very easily into government as well, given the close cooperation between government and corporations. And I don't have any specific examples of how that might be done in terms of adopted video or whatnot, I really couldn't say. But it would surprise me that some of these techniques are used to mislead the people. I don't know. And in this case, you know, I really don't have any permanent examples about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that the media is such an obviously powerful instrument to sway the public. And we go back to the early books about the buying of the selling of the president, going back to the 60s, where advertising became really important issue in political campaigns. I think we've seen that more and more, obviously, that the advertisements, going back to the Johnson bomb, the atom bomb that went off to the little girl, I mean, that was one of the early examples where mm-hmm. advertising became a political tool. So this, you know, now those were, I'm talking about 60s and Brian Wilson Key was the 70s. So what they might do now, is just, I just don't know. I'm curious to see that film.
Yeah. And, well, I, as you were talking, I was thinking, I believe her name was Jessica Lynch, the female soldier who was the subject of a phony video piece that was put out by the Pentagon. It would have been about 2004 or 2005 under the Bush administration.
That's an excellent example, and that's one we found out about. What about ones we didn't find out about?
Ooh, now you're scaring me. Joe Lauria, thank you for your contribution to the Boiling Frogs Post. It's an important commentary on this evolving case about the alleged Iranian-American-Mexican drug cartel plot to kill the Saudi ambassador. And every time I say it just evokes more ridicule and contempt. It's just very hard to assume that they think we are so stupid that we would swallow a big pile of BS like this.
That's what I say.
Joe Lauria, great to have you here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
And before we move on to our next segment, we dip into the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives for a gem from back around 2006 when Bush and Cheney were actively trying to launch an assault on Iran. And you'll hear some of Bush's mangled commentary in this song.
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 bomb,
yes, bomb, Iran.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
Bomb,
Everybody knows about subliminal suggestion, or do we?
We don't have to be honest. We could say we're fine, but there's no use lying. Don't be fooled while the rain is drying. If we stay, there'll be more just like it.
That's an obscure tune from the Flying Turbulon Orchestra. It's called Don't Be Fooled.
If we hide it, hide it.
Filmmaker Jeff Warrick joins us now, and he has produced a fabulous new picture called Programming the Nation, and it takes a look at various aspects of subliminal suggestion and tricks that are played on us in a broad way by advertisers, the media, politicians, propagandists in our Defense Department. Jeff Warrick, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Now, just before you joined us, we were talking with journalist Joe Lauria about this unbelievable new plot that's been exposed by our government, which alleges that an Iranian American in Texas colluded with a drug informant from the Mexican drug cartel, and they got cash from Iran, and they were going to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington. And when I mentioned that, Joe Lauria said, well, I remember a book from the 70s called Subliminal Seduction by Wilson Bryan Key. And so that essentially is what first got you interested in these issues. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. In fact, my father was reading that book when I was just a kid in the 70s. And, you know, he had mentioned, he didn't read the whole book to me. It wasn't a bedtime story. But he did inform me that they were using, you know, messages like eat popcorn, drink Coca-Cola in movie theaters to increase consumption of those products. And it kind of disturbed me. I mean, I figured, I considered that to be a fact coming out of his mouth. And it really, yeah, I wonder what other messages they could be sending us.
Well, and we know that at its fundamental purpose, that advertising is attempting to manipulate us. That's out there in the open, whether it's using a sexy girl to get you to buy a certain brand of beer, or a sexy girl to get you to buy a certain kind of motorcycle. sex is the most obvious one, but they use a lot of rather subtle messaging techniques now that may not be subliminal, but they are kind of covert and manipulative. Would you agree?
Oh, without a doubt. Absolutely. And let's face it, sex is one of the great ones, but they also use things like sexual anxiety and fantasies and things like that that are embedded in advertising that have a subconscious effect to give you longer recognition with whatever the product may be, and also to increase the consumption of things like tobacco and alcohol sales, which I find is pretty frightening. I mean, we all know that people smoke more when they're nervous, so if you can increase their anxiety and make them more nervous, they will smoke more. And that's what I found a lot of, at least our experts have found, is some of the ways in which this technology is being used.
Now, since you read that book way back in the 70s, you went to UC Santa Cruz, you got a double major degree in film and literature, and you've been working in the industry. You've produced films and videos and commercials and documentaries. You're an accomplished screenwriter. So you know what it takes to produce a video, and you know how careful people are about every little frame and every little item that's included.
Oh yeah.
So you actually practice some of these techniques, whether consciously or unconsciously, haven't you?
Yeah, I will admit that, you know, I like playing with the technology as well, and so I think that one of the best ways to illustrate a thing that's being used is to use it and fight fire with fire. So I definitely have employed a lot of the techniques that I'm dissecting in advertising in the film, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is your belief after you conducted all of the research and the interviews for this film? Do certain people in communications, whether it's commercial communications or government information/propaganda, to your knowledge, do they consciously use subliminal techniques to communicate with people and manipulate them?
Well, you know, that is really debatable. And then again, it all depends on what your definition is of subliminal. I think that, you know, things like the letters S, E, X embedded in ice cubes of liquor ads, you know, a lot of that is probably just red herring. And whether they're employing it, I mean, there are examples of that in advertising, and we show some of that in the film. But really, what's interesting to me is that, you know, there was some research that was done in the 80s, and one of the largest executives at a major firm said, if only the general public knew that all advertising is subliminal. In other words, it's all operating on a subconscious level. And I think we show a lot of examples of that in our film, how it's not your traditional notion of subliminal, and we try to expand that. But it definitely is operating on a subconscious level. It's happening in a way where people are unaware of it, and it's definitely manipulative and probably very insidious in a lot of ways, particularly using things, creating anxiety and neurosis in individuals, creating a fear or creating a problem or an illness, and then saying, well, here's the problem, here's the illness, here's the issue, but then we're going to provide you with the cure, and here's the cure. And you see that all the time.
Well, let me offer you an example. I never knew there was a condition called restless leg syndrome until I saw the commercial for the drug that cures it.
Yeah.
And, Jeff, I got a little embarrassed. I embarrassed myself because I made fun of restless leg syndrome on radio programs and got a lot of pushback from people who suffer from what is a chronic condition that can be extremely annoying. And I have a good friend. In fact, I just had lunch with him today, who's got restless leg syndrome. And when I cracked a joke about it, he almost kicked me in the butt with one of his restless legs.
Well, and you know what? Right now my leg's feeling a little restless, too. So I better tread lightly on that. But, there's a lot of ways in which you could analyze this, and we can go in a lot of directions with it. But the pharmaceutical companies and the way that they manufacture these illnesses, whether they're real or not, it also isn't really the point. It goes deeper than that. It's more like things like recently I heard that they have they were analyzing belly buttons, navels. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a perfect one, I mean, we can do some reconstructive surgery. And so now people are all of a sudden concerned about how their belly buttons look, if that isn't the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Well, excuse me, I just invested $2,500 in a belly stud. It's a 4-carat diamond. And after an investment like that, I want to make sure my navel is a proper place to display it.
Well, then there you go. They'll sell you anything if you got the money to buy it, and they're very good at it. So
now, Jeff, your film covers advertising. It covers pop culture. I am a news and politics guy, so I'd like to focus in on the latter part of the film where you talk about political campaigns and also government propaganda.
Okay.
And let's start with 9/11, because I'm an out-truther. I am not embarrassed to say that the official narrative and the description confirmed by the 9/11 Commission is bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
It was a total whitewash. There's a huge cover-up that is obvious to almost anybody who takes a close look. And yet we saw, as the 10th anniversary passed in September, that many people are simply locked in on the official story that they've been told, and you cannot move them, even when you bring out basic high school physics and prove that there was not sufficient heat to cause the towers to melt and collapse. And yet the story holds, and it has to be one of the most effective propaganda disinformation campaigns of my lifetime.
I would wholeheartedly agree, and it boggles my mind how people can still be in denial over this fact as well. I mean, just the fact that the third building that fell, I think it was building 5, actually.
No, building 7.
Building 7.
Yeah.
Was detonated. I mean, they have people over walkie-talkies saying, okay, pull the plug on the building, and the building was detonated. How in the heck did that happen? Why was there a war game taking place on that day where it was depicting planes flying? I mean, there's just so many things about 9/11 that don't make sense. But yet, it seems like people don't feel like connecting the dots. And maybe it's just because it shatters their reality in too much of a way where it just flips their entire concepts of what reality is upside down.
Well, you know? and it's not trivial. There are a lot of people who think, well, you know, it was 10 years ago, Peter, can't you get over it? But it was the pivot point that led us into war in Iraq, led us into the 10-year quagmire in Afghanistan, the open-ended so-called war on terror that now has the next president of the United States assigning people for assassination by drone strikes, including American citizens. And we all just accept this as, not all of us, but way too many of us, accept this as, oh, they're keeping us safe, man. We were attacked on 9/11.
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous, too. And, you know, I mean, I just find it staggering how successful it's been in the long run and how many people still, you know, subscribe to this notion. But and I agree. I don't think it should be just forgotten about. I think it needs to be remembered. I think we need to remember what took place on that day. And we really, what surprises me is that no one's been brought to justice as a result of it. So until someone does, I guess I'm going to keep trying to spread the truth, and I'm not going to forget.
And from your perspective as a documentary filmmaker who has analyzed subliminal suggestion and these areas of manipulation, what key techniques do you see that were used to sell this to the American people?
Well, I mean, they did a lot of things, which was pretty amazing. You mean the actual events of 9/11, or
really more
for war afterwards?
Well, to me, it's really more the story itself and the way the American people just bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I think that no one wants to believe that their government is capable of doing something so sinister. And so if for people to actually take that leap and say, yes, they are, it shatters just a belief level that they just do not want to tread upon. So I really think it's more of a foundational issue and this myth that America would never do something like that to its people, even when there's so much evidence going back to even pre-World War II, that, yes, they would. And the evidence is right there. I mean, the declassified documents right and left, including things like Pearl Harbor, MK Ultra, what happened in Waco, our film shows some of these things. Shows that, yeah, you know, they're not only capable of doing that, but there, you know, there's evidence to support this. So,
well, that's a really valuable point, Jeff, because I've looked at this 9/11 story and covered it in depth, and one of the things that I see there is, and pardon my language here, but the built-in mind fuck, which is that if you explore these issues in any detail, it leads you to very dark considerations about who did this and why.
Yeah.
And it's so repugnant and repulsive that many people approach that and they back off and move into a kind of denial, because even contemplating that our own government could somehow be involved in a devastating and dastardly set of actions like this, it just contradicts all of the programming that we have absorbed since we were kids in school.
That's exactly the case. And so, you know, once you're ready to have your reality blown up and have the Matrix revealed to you for what it is, then, you know, until you're ready to take that leap, you know, that's all you're going to get is this denial. And you're not going to have people that are going to want to face the reality and the truth of what took place.
And, Jeff, forgive me, but my the DVD I was watching kind of crapped out on me in the last 10 minutes of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Did you discuss the Jessica Lynch case at all from the war in Iraq?
No, we didn't really discuss Jessica Lynch.
Okay. Because I thought that was an interesting example. It's not really subliminal, but it was a propaganda piece where the Pentagon created a whole mythology around the incident involving this young female soldier, and she ultimately repudiated it and said, hey, come on, it didn't really happen that way. But it was part of the overwhelming effort where the government was producing this content and our corporate media was playing it and playing it up. It took a long time for reporters to delve in and find out that the Jessica Lynch story was largely a fable.
You know, and there's examples of that throughout media on a regular basis. I mean, you can look at our news you know, our mainstream news programs, and how much of that is really, manipulating the truth or stretching the truth or just blatant lies. And people want, you know, look at this and they say, oh, well, I just want to be informed, you know, and it's just informing me. Well, I mean, if that's your idea of information, it's more like a Hollywood script to me, like some kind of science fiction novel. But a lot of it is just straight up propaganda. And once you come to terms with this and you realize that that's really what's taking place, I mean, it's more of an entertainment than it is news. It's there to get eyeballs. It's there to get attention. It's there to create, you know, their goal is to sell and to have, you know, increase ratings and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. The news is very, very good at this.
We're talking with filmmaker Jeff Warrick. His new film is called Programming the Nation. We'll get you details on where you can see it here before we wrap up. Jeff, you also cover political commercials, including the famous Rats political spot.
Right.
Describe for our listeners how you basically deconstructed that spot, and in slow-mo, you can play it so that we see the text graphic, the word rats, pop up very briefly, very quickly, but large enough for people to read and absorb very late in this political spot. Describe that for us, please.
Well, this was something that was brought out by, I guess it was the Gore campaign, and it did get a little bit of news attention. I think it ran for like 1.5 slots. But, there was an ad. It was an attack ad against Al Gore and his campaign in 2000, specifically against their pharmaceutical plan. And in the ad, they used the word bureaucrats and to describe, you know, the Democrats. And then for just one frame of video, for 1/30th of a second, they have the word, the letters R-A-T-S that become very large. I mean, they're full screen. And so this was an alleged subliminal message to get people to think of the Democrats as rats, allegedly. And so, you know, they asked President Bush about this. He couldn't pronounce the word subliminal. And they had a big chuckle about that, and then they moved on. What's really important about this story to me is that is really the study that took place many, many years later at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, where they showed that by flashing images of the Israeli flag to a control group, that they were able to polarize, what they thought would polarize people to political extremes, they actually brought people closer to the middle as a result of flashing these. And what they were asking them was questions about their beliefs on the Israeli-Palestinian issues. And when it came time for these people to vote, and they followed up with these people over telephone to see how they voted, they found that they voted similarly to the way that they were pushed as a result of these subliminal messages. So in other words, the subliminal messages were able to move people's beliefs and thought patterns and affect the way that they ultimately voted. Is it possible that the rats ad had a similar effect? I mean, I'm not claiming that it had that kind of effect, but it makes you think and wonder.
Well, and you interview the people responsible for the ad, the people who put the money behind it, and one of the producers or editors, I believe, and they act like, wow, I don't know how the hell that happened. Yeah. Now, come on. I am moderately competent with Final Cut Pro, the basic state-of-the-art video editing software today, and I've produced commercials and programs and things like that, and I'm sorry. That would not escape my notice.
No,
it would not happen accidentally. I know how those the character generators work.
Oh yeah,
and for something to be pulled out of a word and blown up full screen for one frame, that is an anomaly that the people who make the Final Cut Pro software would certainly want to look at. But I don't think that anything like that is probable. It couldn't have occurred that way.
No, it's a blatant lie is what it is. It's denial. You know, they get very good at this, and you can see that the Bush campaign, Bush administration particularly, has become probably the biggest experts in the world at plausible deniability, at lying and deceit and deception, and things have kind of taken off since then. And it's a pretty scary world in which we live in which, you know, we're just surrounded in this foggy world of lies.
Jeff, there's one more thing I want to ask you about, but first, tell us when Programming the Nation will be released and where people can see it.
Well, we opened in New York City back in August. It played in Los Angeles last month, and this month it is opening in San Francisco at the Balboa Theater on October 28th. So that's the next opportunity. It'll be running for a week in San Francisco, and after that, we're not quite really sure, but we are planning a DVD release soon to follow. So
right.
It will be available on DVD soon.
Okay.
For more information on that, check out programmingthenation.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have updates and screening locations and all kinds of other useful information, clips, blog articles, and a lot of stuff for information for people.
Great. And I'll put a link to your website, programmingthenation.com, in the show file, a link to this podcast at peterbcollins.com. So the last thing I wanted to talk with you about, I was a rock DJ in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
when the so-called backward masking of audio recording songs was exposed. Those are in air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even a trial over in Reno where parents believe that their child committed suicide because of dark and ugly messages that were embedded in songs, and you had to listen to them backwards in order to pick up those embedded messages. Talk a little bit about this episode, because it got a lot of media attention at the time and scared a lot of parents witless.
Yeah, it did, and you know, maybe wrongfully so, but I think that it's monumental and it deserved being covered in our film, particularly just for the fact that it's it was a wrongful death case, right, against the British rock band Judas Priest.
Mm-hmm.
And other cases like this that had gone to court, well, they actually never had gotten to court. In fact, they were all thrown out and awarded First Amendment protection, most notably the ones that were filed against Ozzy Osbourne and the song Suicide Solution.
Right.
But with this case, what was interesting is that the judge did not award it First Amendment protection, and it did go to trial, and that's huge because he found that subliminal messages would not be awarded First Amendment freedom of speech. So in that sense alone, it's pretty pivotal as far as a court case goes. But in terms of the rock music and the whole genre and the whole backward masking, I think that is a very interesting phenomenon that took place in that period during the 80s particularly. And we investigate this. We look at the alleged satanic messages in Stairway to Heaven,
mm-hmm.
by Led Zeppelin, and we run a little mock experiment with some high school students. And what's interesting is that we prove that by priming those subjects, in other words, by showing them what they're going to hear and telling them what they're going to hear, that they will agree that they do hear that. And whereas
that's called suggestibility.
That's called suggestibility, but it's also called semantic priming and masked priming and things like that. So, you know, what it shows is that these are techniques that are used in advertising all the time. And so to gain consensus, it was used during the Iraq War and the build-up to war. And very, very effectively, and they're all not necessarily what most people think of in terms of subliminal, but they definitely have a subconscious effect on the viewer, and people should be aware of this.
And you've got Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo, and Geoff Tate from Queensryche, who comment on this in the film. And now, frankly, when I compare their denials about backward masking to the people who produced the Bush attack ad on Gore and their denials about the rats, well, I believe the music producers because, I mean, I've been in recording studios often enough to know that the bands, I just don't think they have the time, the money, much less the inclination to try to create secret messages. I mean, I know the Beatles thing worked as a publicity stunt, but I don't think that you know, the guys in Led Zeppelin were sitting there saying, let's pull one over on our fans, mate.
Nor do I. And I think that it's just an interesting period in history where people believed that this was going on. But and so, therefore, we cover it in the film. But I think with artists particularly, I mean, look, a lot of artists employ subliminal techniques, including sound collages or spoken word pieces or just different techniques to create an emotion in the viewer or the listener, whether they're a filmmaker or a musician. And I think they should be awarded a lot more liberties and freedom to kind of play around with this. I mean, when you go into a horror film, you know what to expect. You know that you're going to be scared. And it's the filmmaker's job to scare the hell out of you however he can.
Mm-hmm.
He'll employ whatever techniques that are at his disposal, and he should be able to. That's art. People are walking into that theater. They're not being forced to walk into that theater. And really no one's being forced to turn on their television and watch the news and be subjected to similar techniques being propagandized in this way either.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my thoughts are just that artists really should be given a lot more leeway. And it's really a little bit different when you're trying to manipulate a person to buy or to vote in a certain way or in an election. That's a little more actually a lot more sinister than trying to create heightened senses in art.
And Jeff, I'll leave you with a quick story of manipulation and deception by the record industry. The rock station where I worked in the 80s helped break the headbanger band called Quiet Riot.
Oh, yeah.
And so the guys from the record company came, and they gave us a gold record, and we took pictures, and they were in the trades and all that. So one morning we were bored, and we decided to pull out the gold record from the frame, and we put it on a turntable, and you know what we heard?
Mm.
Andy Williams' Greatest Hits. That's what they used for gold records. They just slap whatever label on it that fit the you know, the award, but the actual gold records were not of the actual record of the artist being honored.
That is hilarious.
Jeff, thanks for a great film. Thanks for joining us today, and I wish you the best.
My pleasure, Peter. Thanks so much.
You bet.
You take care.
Subliminal suggestion. Concocted terrorism plots. Put down that bullshit detector.
Happy trails to you.
And send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.